Edward Gibbon once criticized the Byzantines because they spoke bad Greek, which I guess was because their vernacular didn't quite measure up to his Enlightenment sensibilities. That being said, I should probably mention that Gibbon would be happy with me because I do not speak bad Greek. In fact, I don't speak Greek. And despite having 6 years of it at this venerable institution, my Latin really isn't too far behind it either. So if you hear some unorthodox ways of pronunciations, that's probably the reason why. Someone asked me why I chose Byzantine history. I don't know how much choosing you can do of these kind of things, but I've always looked back on history and sort of viewed it as somewhat inevitable. And I think a lot of my students view it as inevitable as well. You know, was the fall of Rome inevitable? Was the American winning of the Revolutionary War inevitable? A lot of times we say yes. A lot of times we just, you know, assume that it had to be that way because it was that way. And Byzantine history is a great way of showing that the answer to that question is no. Because here you have a society that started off with the same roots as Western civilization and yet came to some very, very different conclusions. So I try to work in as much Byzantine history as possible into my classes. I teach U.S. history. But believe it or not, that's not as big a stretch as it might seem. After all, Constantinople was the nexus of several major spice routes, and the fall of the city with the subsequent closing of the land routes forced Europeans to look elsewhere for their cardamom fix, which in turn led to Bartholomew Diaz rounding the Cape of Good Hope, which and a little bit later led to an adventurous Italian who thought he could save a bit of money by going west to go east. So arguably, Byzantium is a great starting point for any discussion of the discovery of America. With the exception of one Bulgarian student, which I had this year, it also seems to be virgin territory for all of my students. Every year I give them a quiz with two questions as a bonus. The first is to name two Roman emperors, and the second is to name two Byzantine emperors. Most of them get the first question right, and those who don't can blame Julius Caesar for getting assassinated before he could become an emperor. The second question, however, is another matter entirely. Despite the fact that even by the most conservative definition they'd have 88 names to choose from, I've yet to get even one correct response. Hardly surprising, perhaps, given a society so focused on entertainment that more people vote for American Idol than for the president, but no less disturbing for all that. Of course, when I was sitting where they were, literally, or even after graduating college, I probably couldn't have answered the question correctly either. And why would anyone know about the Byzantine Empire? A trip to the local bookstore can be quite revealing. Good luck searching for the section on Byzantium. There most likely won't be one. Despite the fact that what we call the Byzantine Empire was the eastern half of the Roman Empire, its history is not found anywhere near the Roman section. Nor, regardless of the fact that it existed during the Middle Ages, indeed its fall is considered the end of the Middle Ages, is it to be found in the medieval area. The last time I checked, the four books on Byzantium were buried near the history of modern Greece, the dubious logic, I suppose, being that they both spoke Greek. Four books covering a span of 1,200 years. By that standard, the U.S. history section should be confined to about two-thirds of one book. The message is clear. This must not be very interesting or important stuff. Yet, we are all children of Byzantium. We have all sheltered beneath the walls of Constantinople. All of us in the West have been shaped unwittingly by the culture of an empire and a city whose story we don't know. Like most people, I grew up thinking that Western civilization started with the ancient Greeks, continued with the Romans, then came Christianity, then the fall of the Roman Empire in 476 when Romulus Augustulus was put out to pasture, then came the Dark Ages, then the Middle Ages, etc., etc. But what no one told me was that the Roman Empire didn't really fall in 476 at all. The Western half, including Rome, certainly fell victim to barbarians, Goths, Visigoths, and all that. But the eastern half, centered around Constantinople, endured. surviving behind its massive walls until the terrible guns of the invading Turks at last breached them 1,000 years later. Constantinople remained the glittering capital of Christendom for all that time, the visible symbol of all that had been lost in the West. At the time of the Fourth Crusade, the Venetians maintained that fully 1/4 of the wealth of the world was contained behind its walls, and they should know since they looted most of it. Its population was 20 times that of London, perhaps more than in all the Kingdom of England at that time. Its relics were the finest, its churches the largest, its art the most breathtaking. While Charlemagne was struggling to learn how to write his own name, Byzantine schoolchildren were studying Homer and Aeschylus, writing like Thucydides and debating the virtues of Plato and Aristotle. While the old Roman Imperium sunk into chaos and darkness, Byzantium remained a shining light. More than just the preserver of Christian civilization, it was Christian civilization. The city itself exerted an almost mystical pull. Kings in the West tried to copy it, popes tried to rival it, and as far away as Scandinavia, it was known simply as Miklagard, the city. Why weren't we told? We are the heirs of Athens because Byzantium preserved classical Greek literature for us. Their greatest emperor, Justinian, codified and gave us Roman law. While civilization in the Dark Age Europe was only dimly kept alive in remote monasteries, and European culture was, in the words of Lord Clark, squeaking through by the skin of its teeth, Byzantine bakers debated theology, emperors and princesses wrote histories, and perfumed couriers quoted Homer as fluidly as we quote Shakespeare. Central heating, polo, orphanages, public baths, hospitals, women doctors, golden automata shaped like birds which sang tunes, hydraulic air conditioning, thrones which could appear to levitate at the touch of a lever. Constantinople had all these wonders and more. No wonder the Byzantines looked down on the Crusaders in their drafty castles and aversions to baths. Byzantine art and architecture was glorious, and it was more than just the romantics who felt the spell the city on the Bosphorus has cast down through the centuries. The mosaics scattered throughout its churches inspired painters as diverse as Giotto and El Greco. Peter the Great tried to copy its domes and spires in St. Petersburg. Al-Malik borrowed its style for his Dome of the Rock, and Charlemagne modeled his buildings in Aachen on the vast, glorious imperial palace of New Rome. Even St. Mark's in Venice is patterned after the vanished wonder of the Church of the Holy Apostles. But the crowning achievement, the visible symbol of the sacred and the secular, is the Hagia Sophia. Upon entering his great church for the first time, Justinian is said to have exclaimed, "Solomon, I have surpassed thee." Though it no longer shines with golden mosaics, though its art has been defaced and the incense and chanting have long since gone, though 600 years of oppression have robbed it of most of its glory, it still remains the one spot a modern visitor can peel back the centuries and gaze at the power of Byzantium revealed. The first time I saw it was a revelation. Scales tumbled from my eyes. Ich bin ein Byzantiner. Had Constantinople done nothing other than simply exist for 1,000 years, it would still have done the West an invaluable service. After all, the shadow of its walls stopped the seemingly irresistible Muslim tide, forcing the armies of Islam to take the long way through North Africa and Spain, overextending their resources and giving Europe the time it needed to resist. Thomas Cahill was wrong. The Irish didn't save civilization, the Byzantines did. Why weren't we told? How could I have been a history major specializing in the ancient and medieval worlds and not know this story by heart? The answer to that question of the disregard of the West for the East is almost as old as Europe itself and is the tragic legacy of the central fault line through Christendom between those who looked East and those who looked West. Officially, the split came in 1054 over the filioque, that troublesome word in the Nicene Creed which Catholics add and Orthodox omit, that decides whether the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father and the Son together or just the Father. But in truth, the two halves of the empire had been drifting apart long before the West succumbed to barbarian invasions. As early as the 6th century, when Justinian reconquered Italy, there were those who pointed out that it felt more like a foreign invasion than a rescue. 200 years later, the iconoclastic controversy, declaring as it did that religious art was synonymous with idolatry, drove the first real wedge between the churches, poisoning relations and opening the sluice gates of invective excommunications and counter-excommunications. By the time of the First Crusade, when the awestruck Crusaders entered the fabled city, Easterners and Westerners were barely on speaking terms. The Crusaders must have felt a mixture of wonder, jealousy, disgust, and probably some confusion as to why these effeminate, perfumed Greeks, who crossed themselves in the wrong way and covered their food in olive oil, were deserving of help at all. Byzantine diplomacy, so necessary for the survival of the reduced empire, was seen as sneaky, duplicitous, and unmanly. And this craven spirit was widely blamed in the West for the betrayal of the First and the failure of the Second and Third Crusades. The Byzantines, for their part, found their guests to be boorish, crude men with nothing other than fighting ability to recommend them. The Emperor Alexius even wondered, with good reason, whether he had more to fear from the Turks or the Crusaders. But the final divorce between East and West, if it hadn't happened already, came in the wake of the tragic Venetian-led Fourth Crusade. The bitterness of that blow, forgotten so quickly by the West, endured in the Byzantine memory. When the noose tightened in the 15th century, and the only chance to avoid extinction at the hand of the Turks was to join the Orthodox and Catholic churches by submitting to the Pope, the Byzantines responded by saying, "Better the Sultan's turban than the Pope's mitre." It has in many ways been mutual contempt, and Western attitudes toward the East have vacillated between condescension and outright dismissal. After the fall of the empire, the German writer Hieronymus Wolff, wanting to drive home the point that the Holy Roman Empire was the real Roman Empire, coined the term Byzantine to refer to the impostors who had ruled from Constantinople. Bishop Liutprand wrote that Byzantium was populated by idle liars of neither gender. And no less an authority than Voltaire held that Byzantine culture was a worthless collection of orations and miracles. But the real blow to their reputation came in 1776, when Edward Gibbon published his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. He saw Byzantium as an authoritarian, corrupt, and worst of all, irrational. And like all the scholars of the Enlightenment, he preferred to find his roots in ancient Greece and Republican Rome. In his own words, he described Byzantine history as 1,000 years of decline and condemned it as a dark slide into barbarism, corruption, and decay. The shrunken little empire, which spoke bad Greek and didn't control the city of Rome, was judged to be essentially unimportant, with no enduring lessons other than the depravity of man. It was a critique from which the Byzantine reputation never recovered, and the word Byzantine became a synonym for effeminate decadence and unnecessary complexity. Such an unwarranted and sweeping condemnation is a travesty enough, but forget for a moment that without the Byzantines, there would be no Cyrillic and a vastly different Russian history. Forget the long shadow it still casts over the Slavic and Middle Eastern worlds. Forget of the 55,000 ancient Greek texts that we have, over 40,000 were transmitted by Byzantine scribes. Forget that Cassiodorus built the first scriptorium in an attempt to recreate the learning he saw in Constantinople. Forget that it was a Byzantine emigre bringing with him a partial copy of Aristotle to the West in the 12th century, who sparked the rise of scholasticism. Forget that Boccaccio and Petrarch were tutored by Byzantines, or that Byzantines fleeing the wreck of their homeland in the Quattrocento, bringing with them Plato and the rest of Aristotle, kickstarted the Renaissance. If their only gift to us had been the transmission of ancient Greek thought, then that would have been a steep enough debt to repay. But Byzantium was more than just a passive repository of classical traditions. It was, in Byron's famous phrase, a triple fusion, a Roman body, a Greek mind, and a mystic soul. Springing from the same cultural fountainhead that birthed the West, it nevertheless answered several fundamental questions differently. And perhaps the most insidious casualty of the Western disregard for the East is its dismissal of these answers. Byzantium's voice has gone unheard and its lessons left unheeded. In the second century, Tertullian asked, "What does Jerusalem have to do with Athens?" Deeply suspicious of secular writings and alarmed by the paganism around him, he meant for his listeners to come to the conclusion that the answer was nothing. And so in the West they did. Boethius, the last Westerner before Aquinas to seriously ask the question, found himself in a Gothic prison cell, writing his masterpiece On the Consolation of Philosophy while he was awaiting execution. As the Dark Ages descended, the heirs of Athens and Jerusalem had to decide which heritage to save, the classical or the Christian one. And faced with that choice, they chose Jerusalem. Secular writings were expendable, and monasteries were not libraries. Classical texts were valuable only for the material they were written on, and so they were painstakingly scraped from the parchments to be reused for more appropriate writing. The Enlightenment effectively swung the pendulum in the opposite direction, rejecting mysticism as the cluttered superstitions of a less illuminated age. They tried to sweep away the trappings of the Middle Ages, replacing Jerusalem firmly with Athens. Faith could be reconciled with reason, it turned out, by relegating faith to those areas unconcerned with public life. And Athens, it must be said, has been kind to the West. Rationalism unlocked the secrets of the atom and the miracle of DNA. It holds out the promises of extended lives, nearly painless and disease-free. It tantalizes us with comforts undreamed of by our ancestors. It opened the possibility to travel virtually anywhere and built a vast communications array where virtually anyone could talk to anyone else, anywhere, at any time. There need be no reason to ever feel alone. And yet our headlines read of Columbine and Virginia Tech. Our rock songs speak of alienation and disillusionment. Our schools are filled with cynical students who sedate themselves with video games and view education as the path to a better school or a better job, not as a way to better themselves or mankind. We are, in C.S. Lewis's words, creating a society of men without chests, who deal with the crushing hopelessness of this dystopian vision by distracting themselves to the point where they stop thinking about it at all. Surely we are missing something. Surely we can admit that something is dreadfully wrong. The Islamic East, it would seem, is at the other end of the spectrum, taking as they did virtually the opposite path. At first heavily influenced by the older Byzantine civilization, there had been an initial flowering of science and philosophy, resulting in the Umayyads' architectural triumph and the cosmopolitan cities of Moorish Spain. But they had ultimately rejected Athens and turned inward, and this movement, diametrically opposed to what was happening in Europe, ensured that the dialogue between the East and the West was mutually unintelligible. Such then are the choices that history has laid before us. Either we accept Western rationalism with its attendant deficiencies, or we accept the religious fanaticism of the Middle East, which has even less to recommend it. But there is a third option, a Byzantine tradition which has remained unheard in Western halls of academia, but has much to offer. While the West stopped asking Tertullian's question, Byzantium became defined by it. Unlike the West, it emerged from the Dark Ages with a stable, centralized state intact. Where the West had a sharp break with its classical past, Byzantium had continuity. Constantinople's walls proved impregnable against its many enemies, and the learning of its ancient heritage was preserved. Much of it was too laced with secular reasoning to be fully embraced by the devout Christian society, but it was too dazzling, too beautiful, and too deeply ingrained to be discarded. The result was a Christian society with a secular educational system, a seemingly contradictory foundation of Greek secular thought with Christian mysticism, worlds apart from what was occurring in the West. They managed this delicate balancing act between Athens and Jerusalem by dividing knowledge into two parts. Ancient Greek secular literature was called outside wisdom, useful in pointing to the truth, but needing careful study to reveal it. Christian literature, especially the lives of the saints, was called inside wisdom, and this was easier to access. St. Basil of Caesarea, an early 4th century Eastern father, wrote a bestseller on the subject entitled Two Young Men on How They Might Derive Profit from Pagan Literature. In it, he points out the moral value of pagan authors. After all, they praised virtue and so could be used to gain valuable insight from the outside wisdom. Of course, they also featured patricide, infanticide, and just about every one of the seven deadly sins, so it was the duty of the reader to use a healthy grain of salt to distinguish between the good passages and the bad, drawing the appropriate moral lessons as they went along. Somehow it's hard to see the Venerable Bede urging the same thing. Not that there wasn't controversy or tension. Byzantium constantly simmered in a religious ferment. Christian hardliners were always suspicious of Greek rationalism, but St. Basil's words remain the mainstream opinion for over 1,000 years. Even the Byzantine Dark Age couldn't quite extinguish this blending of classical and Christian ideas. With the plague raging, the forces of Islam pressing in, the the Balkans collapsing, and civil wars erupting. Homer continued to be part of the curriculum. Private tutors still taught Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Herodotus. And Plato and Aristotle continued to be the philosophers. When Byzantium recovered in the 10th century during the Macedonian revival, its classical traditions were intact. Higher learning was revived, scholars once again took up their pens, and those dormant classical foundations sprang once again into full bloom. And it's fortunate for us they did. Most of the copies of the Greek classics that we have today date from this time. The elegant synthesis of Athens and Jerusalem finally broke down in the 15th century, as even the most optimistic citizen of Constantinople could see the handwriting on the wall. As their temporal power waned, there was a final flowering of Byzantine culture, but this time there was a firm dividing line. The humanists maintained that the only way to avoid conquest by the Turks was to come to a compromise with the Western Catholics, which, practically speaking, meant subordination. The monks, who are called hesychists, which means holy quiet, because they believed that meditation and repetitious prayer would lead to a mystical union with the Godhead, rejected the possibility, abandoning this life for the hope of a better one in the next. For the first time, the Byzantines were forced to decide which was the more important legacy, the Christian or the classical one. Ultimately, they chose orthodoxy over political survival. The humanists went west to start the Renaissance, and the monks retreated to their monasteries and endured the Turkish occupation. What was lost on May 29th, 1453, as the Turks swarmed into Constantinople and the last emperor disappeared into legend, was a holistic, balanced view of Athens and Jerusalem. As an Athenite monk put it, the Byzantines saw the world in three ways. The first was through the eye of the senses, that of the empirical sciences. The second was through the eye of reason, that of philosophy, logic, and mathematics. And the third way was through the eye of contemplation, systematic and disciplined meditation and divine revelation. Rather than cultivating all three, historically the West has let one approach become dominant to the exclusion of the others. Ever since the Enlightenment, it has reduced all knowledge to the eye of the senses and done its level best to ignore any spiritual dimension. As a result, looking at Byzantium can be a profoundly alien experience. After all, we're not used to riots starting over hair-splitting theological differences or religious slogans being sung in the streets together with discussions of Homer or Herodotus. We may find it odd, as many Westerners did, to find bakers and cooks engaged in heated arguments over doctrinal niceties one moment and a classical Greek author the next. But this dimension is precisely what makes the Byzantine voice worth listening to. And to ignore it or to gloss over it is to produce a dangerously stilted view of history. Such mistakes are hard to avoid in the West. Even the engaging and usually astute historian John Julius Norwich writes that the monks were in the end a destructive influence in Byzantium, draining the lifeblood of the empire over the centuries, drawing vital manpower away into the sterile monastic life, which ultimately contributed nothing to Byzantine cultural, territorial, or artistic development. Without understanding the role of outside and inside wisdom, we can never fully appreciate the balance the Byzantines struck between Athens and Jerusalem. Nor can we then really hear their voice at a time when every headline tells us our current understanding is at best incomplete. Their legacy of stable government in a region inherently thought of as unstable deserves to be studied, not ignored and forgotten. They were like us, a mixture of heroes and scoundrels, honest men and corrupt politicians, saints and sinners, simultaneously inspired and deeply flawed. But their contributions have been ignored, their legacy dismissed, and their voices silenced. Their story is left untold, and the lessons they taught left unheeded. As that inveterate critic Voltaire wrote, "Those who do not learn from the past are doomed to repeat it." We cannot learn from what we don't know. Now more than at any time in our past, we need the lessons afforded by Byzantine history to strike a new balance between Athens and Jerusalem. We disregard their lessons about inside wisdom at our own peril, and by consigning them to the dustbin of history, we only impoverish ourselves. Thank you.